Hello and welcome to episode number 53 of the Learning Digital Photography Podcast. This week our theme is Finding Your Creative Voice. With me on the show this week is the popular Andy Smith, all the way from down south in Texas. So we're talking way down south. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hey Jason.
How you been doing lately?
Good, how about you?
I'm doing outstanding. Thank you for coming on the show again.
Anytime.
For those of you that may not remember, Andy has been on the show in the past, and we've talked about quite a bit here on the show, and hopefully it's been entertaining for everyone. So it's like I said, today we're going to be talking about finding your creative voice. We're going to be tackling some of the more deep and hopefully thought-provoking subjects relative to photography. And this actually came up recently in a subject of conversation when I was talking to some other friends about how technical things have... I'm going to turn off my video if you keep turning yourself upside down. And I'm just going to leave that in the podcast so you can just sound silly for all the world to hear. Ha! But anyway, I'm not going to look at her while I say this part of the show. But we're going to be talking about finding your creative voice. And this came about when people have mentioned to me in the past about talking about photography and its roots of reading to paint with light, the photographos and all that. But I've never heard people really talking on shows about why you paint with this light and what the purpose is behind your photography, whether you're trying to capture some emotional desire or something that's moving to you or even telling some kind of story. And she can keep making those faces when I forget to cover the video. I should just turn the video off. Oh, I should screen capture that and put it out with the podcast. But these are typically the reasons why we capture images, whether it's our emotional desires or whatever's moving to us. And we never really talk about them and what motivates you to shoot. So I brought Andy on the show primarily because she has always been really good at least in my opinion, on capturing things from an emotional perspective and covering quite a bit. Like I've noticed you don't often stick, Andy, to strictly portrait work or strictly landscape work or even event work. Like it's like you find a little bit of everything. You're just capturing the world around you. So I thought she would be a good one to bring on the show to talk about finding ways to find inspiration and your creative voice and what the story is that you want to tell. And I just want to put that first part out there to kind of set the stage as for what we're talking about, why we're talking about it, and why each of us is here to talk about it. And the first point that really comes to mind in talking about this subject is really about finding a creative voice. And Andy, I actually would like to turn it over to you for a little to have you share some insights on how you found your creative voice when you started getting into photography. And during this juncture, while you try and talk seriously, I'm going to make faces at you.
Okay, so, I'm just trying to ignore you then.
Oh, well, see, most people do, so I'm used to that. But anyway, I'm kidding. So please do share a little bit of insight. How did you get started in photography? What was the... what was your passion? Like, why photography? What's photography for you? Do you think you found a creative voice? If you have, how did you find it, and how did you get to where you are today?
Well, I started as a kid, really, with the little 110 camera that my parents allowed two rolls of film on family vacations. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to capture what I saw on vacation. So in Puerto Vallarta, I have a lot of images of not necessarily just the beach, but there's a church in the downtown area that I just found beautiful, and I just tried to capture that to share with my friends back home.
Okay.
And when...
What kind of... It's interesting you said that, though. What kind of one... Not to interrupt. What kind of 110 camera were you using? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Because I just got started with a Vivitar 110.
I'm sure mine was a Vivitar.
I think most of them were Vivitars. So, graduated from the Vivitar 110 to the Pentax K1000 SE I sold for my brother. So this is kind of funny when you said that. I was like, ooh, what kind of 110 was that? So, but we're not talking about gear today. Get away from the gear. So anyway, you had these photo albums you brought back.
And so every year we went on a big vacation as a family, and I'd always bring back photos to share with my friends. And then when I moved out, I didn't really have a camera, and I did some really cool things. I wish that I had a camera for when I was part of a hot air balloon team that I don't have any pictures of.
You were on a hot air balloon team?
I was.
That sounds pretty cool, actually.
It was cool. It was a very cool year of my life.
Now, on the hot air balloon team, were you one of the photographers, or like taking pictures of all the stuff, or were you actually participating, like getting them off the air and like going in the races and those kinds of things?
I was part of the crew. I didn't really seriously look at photography until after I got married, because our wedding photographer gave us the most horrible wedding images back. They didn't tell a story. They didn't capture moments. They were out of focus. They had flash cords in them. And I flat out...
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, I told them that I could have done a better job, and I don't even own a camera. So that year for my with my bonus check from work, I actually bought a film Rebel and just started taking pictures of the world around me. I'd go to the park at lunch break. I would take pictures of my desk. I just wanted to share what I saw. And I find that that's what I still do. I'll have my camera in my car and pull off onto the side of the road when I see something interesting. Voice is found around me. I don't really set out and to tell a set story, but when I see something I like, I try to find a story within it.
So do you still find yourself that you take pictures at your desk? Like, oh, hey, that looks like a cool angle to the speaker or the printer or whatever.
I posted a picture of a pencil on my desk today on Facebook.
See, I'm not on, that's what I need. I need to get more on Facebook because I don't participate in that enough. So that's why I didn't know about your pencil picture.
Yes.
Cool.
So yes, I do.
And so when you do these kinds of things where you like take pictures from your desk or take pictures when you stop by the side of the road, I guess more of the deeper question is what moves you to take a picture of that pencil, or what moves you to take a pic to stop? Like, why would you stop? What, you know, what catches you or what inspires you when you take your images?
Sometimes it's the light that I see. Sometimes it's an object.
Okay.
I have a fondness of barns, and thankfully I live in Texas, so we have a plethora of barns.
You got a lot of barns in Texas, yeah.
Yes. Some of it's just the lines that I see that I like. Today's pencil picture was, I was crunching numbers, so it was a moment in my life that it represented what I was doing today.
So would you consider your photography then to be capturing moments in your life that you want to share with the world? Or is it capturing moments?
Capturing for fun, for myself. If I'm shooting for the paper, I'm shooting moments in somebody else's life.
So, and is that how you're telling your story? Is that like the story that you're telling then? Like this moment of my life or this moment in someone else's life? Like what?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Or it may not be somebody. It may be something. It could
like the pencil. Sure.
Right.
Sure. Cool. And do you still find yourself motivated by the same things today that first or initially motivated you in photography? As far as like subject matter, what catches your eye, what draws you? Because and here's why. Let me set the stage a little bit. When I first started getting into photography, at least on a more serious level, because like I said, you know, we all started way back with a lot of film stuff. And what got me more interested in it was when I was doing some web design work in the IT world, and I'm using these pictures from other people's sites at the time that just looked horrible. And I was like, my God, I've got to be able, like you said, I've got to be able to take better pictures than that. You know, how hard can it be? Then I picked up an SLR, digital SLR camera, and I was like, oh, wow, look, cool, a shutter. Hey, there's some technical stuff I can figure out. And, ooh, there's an aperture. I can figure that out. And, ooh, ISO, and, ooh, composition. And, you know, I started figuring out all these technical details of it before I really started delving into the deeper nuances of photography and capturing things from an emotional perspective. You know, what draws you to an image? Just like you said, is it the light of the scene? Is it the color of the scene? Is it how an object is lit, you know, those more subtle meanings behind photos. So for me, it was a rather upside down movement into photography. And since I did that movement in an upside down fashion where I started with technical and then started to get creative, whereas most people probably start creative and then start to learn the technical, at some point, you know, it's, especially when people start in the more traditional sense where they start in the creative, learn about the technical, and then find it difficult to get back to the creative, or in my case, learning the creative after the technical is done. And I think that's where a lot of people have problems, is now that they've got the technical done, and they've got all these technical sundry bits of information like aperture and shutter and ISO and composition and rule of thirds and 7/16 and overexposing one stop, overexposing two stops, underexposing the light, the main light, the fill light, the hair light, doing all these technical things, and then getting to a point where you don't have to think about it and getting more artistic and finding images that move you.
Right. I think the same things catch my eye. It's always been old buildings, something with a history to them. I still photograph that, but I've added sports to that and people, and airplanes have always been something I've photographed.
Airplanes are cool. I've always liked airplanes too. I've never really had an opportunity to. Now, do you take pictures from the airplanes or of the airplanes or both?
Both.
Which would you say is your stronger forte in that area?
Static images, so when they're on the ground. I try to catch bits and pieces of them. I've had a lot of photographers who are aircraft photographers say that my work is different because I capture the bits and pieces. I have ground school background, so I understand how the planes work, and I kind of try to capture that. I don't see them as a whole. I see them really as a piece of art. Happens to fly. So I think that comes through in my images.
Cool.
People said they do, it does.
And that brings up kind of an interesting, I guess, side or tangential point, because a lot of this whole question of what drives your creativity, you know, where is your creative voice? Oftentimes people will define their creative voice by a particular genre of photography, like we alluded to earlier, whether it's portraiture or event work or wildlife or, like you just said, you know, I guess aviation photography. So would you consider being creative restricting yourself to one particular genre, or do you think it's important to across multiple genres in finding your creative vision?
I think your creativity gets old. I think you run out of creativity. I think if you don't branch out to something different, I think you stop being creative. I think a lot of your images become cookie cutter. It may be a different airplane or a different person, but you end up taking the same photo over and over and over again.
Right. You know, it's kind of interesting you mentioned that, because I was talking to another photographer friend of mine just the other day about landscape photography, and he said something interesting. He said, how many sunsets can you have in your portfolio?
One.
Well, because from his whole point, that's most of what he's been doing is sunrise, sunset, landscape kind of things, and sunrise and sunset typically tend to be the times of day when the light is the best, so that's typically what you're catching.
Right.
When you're doing landscape work, and he said, how many times can you take a different sunset? And of course, the answer is every single time, because they're always different.
Right.
But you can fall, like you said, you fall into these patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the danger of sticking to a particular genre. And that kind of ties into another podcast that happened a while back with David Duchemin when he came on the show, and we were talking about his new book at the time. What was it? Vision Mongers, I think we were talking about. I forget if it was Vision Mongers or the one before it. But he was talking about not being classified by a particular genre of photography. Like, he wouldn't say, I'm a portrait photographer, or I'm a landscape photographer, or I'm a still art photographer. He referred to himself as just a storyteller.
Right. I tell people when they ask me what I photograph, I tell them nouns, people, places, and things.
I photograph nouns.
Mm-hmm.
I guess better than photographing verbs or punctuation or anything. I photograph nouns.
Actually, I do photograph verbs since I'm a sports photographer as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. That's kind of funny. That's fun. But, yeah, it brought up an interesting point about the different genres of photography and whether or not it's okay to classify yourself under one particular genre, or if it's important to expand and, I guess, diversify, for lack of a better phrase, across multiple genres. And I see a lot of people saying, well, yeah, I want to do it. And that's my problem, is I say I want to do it all, you know, but then other people will say, yes, you may want to do it all, or at least have the ability to do it all, but you won't become an expert in any of it unless you focus on one field. And it's that mentality of, like, the jack of all trades, the master of none sort of approach, where, yeah, you can be okay in all of them, but then you won't be really good in any of them unless you focus. Do you find any validity to that statement? Or that not statement, but that perspective about
not
genres?
Really. I see photography as photography. I still think of rule of thirds and, you know, all the rules that we were taught and all the technical stuff we were taught. If I'm shooting an airplane, it's a portrait of an airplane. If I'm shooting a senior, it's a portrait of a senior. If I'm shooting architecture, it's a portrait of the building. So really, well, I just see it as photography. And I may, my subject may be different. My job is to tell a story.
Okay, so here's an interesting question, because when you had said that you're when you do architecture type work, you like to bring the history of it into the scene where it's got some history or some story to it. Would you find that portrait work, you'd also want to at least bring some kind of historical or reference of some sort of the person, you know, what the person's about? Like, for, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, since she's a Dallas Cowboys fan. So the first thing that came to mind for me was a cowboy. So if you're going to take a portrait shot of a cowboy, would you want them to be like pulling their boot on, or, you know, tipping their cowboy hat, or doing something, or having some kind of association with that theme? Or do you like to take people out of their element and see how they are in other elements? Like, what approach would you take towards doing portraiture in terms of telling a story? Like, when you take a person's portrait, how are you telling a story?
When I do portraits, I ask my clients to wear, especially seniors, I ask them to bring stuff that's meaningful to them. So some of my favorite senior portraits, I had a senior who was going to go to Baylor University, and they're the Baylor Bears.
Right.
So she brought a teddy bear, and I did that classic little kid shot of her holding the teddy bear by its hand and walking away. You've seen it a billion times when the kid's like
mm-hmm.
two.
Yeah.
I captured it when the kid was 18. Huh. And that was meaningful to her because she's a Baylor Bear.
Right. That came through in the image. So that was part of the story was
right.
And see, that's interesting.
Right. Sometimes I'll have another senior went to Coppell. They're the Coppell Cowboys. She's wearing her prom dress with cowboy boots in the middle of Deep Ellum, which is an art district.
That's cool. That's cool.
I asked them to bring something of them, you know, something that
sure.
means something to them. It may not be in a location that tells their story, but something in that image is going to tell their story.
Interesting. So then I guess the next question that kind of ties into the third portion of this is finding your creative voice. So for those listeners that haven't been nodding their head, because I'm sure as we're talking about all this stuff, a lot of people are nodding their head saying, yeah, that's great, that's interesting, I agree, you know, I disagree, whatever, because they've found their creative voice. So for those listeners out there that haven't found their creative voice, what's the best way to, I guess, break out of the technical and find some sort of creative motivation or some creative voice that can help drive? Because from my perspective, if you're not shooting with any passion or any kind of emotional investment in your images, it's going to show through.
Right.
In the images that you take. And more often than not, especially lately, a lot of people are asking me questions via email. And I guess this could be a good segue into some listener questions and answers. But a lot of the questions that I get is, well, what if I'm stuck in a rut? Or what if I can't find a creative voice? Or what if, like you said, like you're into aviation photography and you're into sports photography and you're into portraiture photography. Why do I have to pick one? You know, what, you know, I'm having trouble picking one. You know, how would you recommend that people find a particular path that is inspirational or motivational for them to pursue?
Well, that's really a two-part answer. I think if you're a photographer out there and you're bored with what you're photographing, what you're capturing, go try something new. I know a ton of portrait photographers who never take a landscape photograph.
That's my other friend, Carrie. He's like that. He can't stand landscape photography.
Go take some landscape. It doesn't mean to have to be trees. Your landscape could be the park.
Wait a minute. There's trees in landscapes? I'm kidding.
Every once in a while I see them. I live in the plains of Texas, so I don't see too many of them.
Oh, no, I just meant landscapes in general. I wasn't picking on Texas. I was being specific. But yeah, I think that's a good point. That's a good
branch
point.
Branch off. Try something new.
So if
you haven't found your voice at all, listen to it. It's there. Your mind may be telling, oh, that would be telling yourself, that would be a really cool picture, but oh, I couldn't take it that well. Go take it. Go take that image that your head's saying, oh, that'd be cool. That would be a really cool picture. Now, I always say I pull off to the side of the road. I do. I am famous for pulling off to the side of the road, especially on country roads.
Are cars like honking at you to get out of their way as they drive by? Or
no, I always pull off to the shoulder.
That's funny. Okay, but say, for example, you know, like you say, you find something off to the side of the road and you take a picture of it, or to go find something new. What if people are having trouble finding motivation, or they're having trouble picking something new to go shoot, for lack of a, well, I keep saying for lack of a better phrase. I apologize to those listening. For lack of a better phrase, I'm trying to move that out of my vocabulary. But the question still remains, you know, how do you find a creative voice when you don't know what to shoot? So say, for example, a person's a portrait artist and you say, well, break out of that mold, go shoot a landscape. Okay, what landscape? Do you mean a landscape of the city street?
Sure.
Do you mean the landscape of the buildings? You know, none of them interest me. So if the question then becomes, if it doesn't interest me, how am I supposed to capture that and still tell a story? You see what I'm saying? It's kind of a double-edged sword, because if you're shooting out of your comfort zone, then you don't know, it's not really moving to you, so it's going to be more difficult to find a creative vision in that space. And then
right. I think people get, I think we've been raised with so many rules and so many, no, you can't do that, or only do one thing, that right. Our heads tell us, oh, I don't like that, before we even really look at it. A building is a building, but maybe the windows are really neat, or maybe the tiles are really neat.
The thing I like to do about in cases like that, like you were saying, is look at a smaller element of a building, kind of like what you said with your aviation
right.
photography, where you don't look at the whole building, you look at a portion of it, or you don't look at the whole airplane, you look at a portion of it, or you juxtapose whatever the subject matter is to something else. So you take a picture of a building on the edge of a forest, or
right, or watch the building. Are people walking out of it? Like if you're a portrait photographer and you can't stand taking an image without a person in it, try hitting downtown at 5 o'clock when everybody's leaving those buildings.
Hey, that's a good idea. That's a great idea. And you know, it's funny, because just at work the other day, I went out on lunch to, I think I wanted to go grab a soda or something, and I was coming back and I was stopped at a red light, and as I was stopped at this light, it's a relatively busy street, right? So most of the time when the light is red, there's tons of people walking around
right.
during this red light. But during this particular point in the day, for some reason, no one was out walking around. And this old lady who had like this grocery cart, I guess she was a homeless person or something, but she started walking across the street and then passed her on the street. The street continued to go downhill, and then you saw the mountains off in the distance. And it had a very Cartier-Bresson kind of street photography feel to it. And I was killing myself that A, I was in my car, the light was about to turn green, and B, I couldn't get my camera turned on fast enough, and there were cars sitting behind me. And it's like one of those, you know, moments where you wish you had the shot.
Right.
You know, and I think that can often be, I guess, the beginning of new inspiration, is when, you know, you see something by accident.
Right. You can ease yourself into a new genre. Like for me, the longest time, my images didn't have people in them. And then I started realizing that cityscape is a lot more interesting with people in it. So I'd add people in some of them.
Now, what I've often wondered, though, is when doing cityscapes with people in them, do you find that the images work better because there's people in them, or because you're juxtaposing, like, the person to the building? Or is it both, or?
I think it's a little bit of both. It really depends on the image. I mean, I have an image in my portfolio of the Alamo with not a single person in it, and it's a great image of the portfolio.
Not that you're modest or anything like that, so, you know.
No, I'm
just kidding. I've seen that. I know the one you're talking about, because and that's the other thing is,
when art directors tell me that it reminds them of Keith Carter, I Sorry, it's a good image.
Yeah, it's a compliment. And that actually kind of ties into the other thing I was going to get at in terms of finding a creative voice is look at the work of other photographers.
But don't try to copy them. I think we have a lot of that going on right now, that so many photographers read other photographers' blogs, and we're in a rut of, oh, but so-and-so does this, and so-and-so does this, and everybody's images are starting to look a lot alike.
Which is kind of the motivation, there's the word again, the motivation for this particular podcast, because when you find yourself getting in a rut, whether it be because you're shooting the same things that everyone else is shooting, or because you're shooting the same thing that you've always been shooting, how do you break out of that rut? How do you break out and do something different than what everyone else is doing, or do something different from what you've been doing? And the question then becomes, how to break out of that rut. And I think we've hit on a couple really good ways to find new paths or directions to express a creative vision. But I think there's probably a couple other things that we could probably suggest. And one thing I've done is I've gone through the alphabet, for example.
That's always a fun assignment.
Yeah, going through the alphabet and saying, okay, I'm going to find the letter A somewhere, in a downtown metro A, or I'm going to find something that begins with the letter A and take a picture of that, and then find something that begins with the letter B. So, okay, B, barn. Okay, I got to find a barn. Okay, C, cat. Got to find a cat. That kind of thing. And that can lead to inspiration and motivation.
You can do that with colors, too, so you can work your way through the
colors. Yep, colors work as well. So you could take the Roy G. Biv and find something that's red, find something that's orange, all the way through. Numbers are a good way to do that as well. So you pick any kind of subject matter, whether it's letters, numbers, colors, shapes even. Circles, squares, and triangles are great sources of inspiration. Try and find a triangle. There was a TV commercial on a while back where they took regular objects and illustrated them as smiles.
Oh, right.
I forget what the ad was for, but I think probably most of us have seen that at some point in time, whether it's even drawing a blank as to what the smiles were. But it was a very creative vision that the developers of that particular advertisement did, so much so that it still sticks with me to a certain degree today.
Right, and most things in life and in the world, you can narrow down to a shape. Right now, my wallpaper on my laptop is a great image of Cowboy Stadium that one of the Dallas Morning News photographers took.
Cool.
And I'm looking at it, and I go, oh, there is a triangle, there's a square, there's a rectangle, it's a half a circle.
Yeah.
And I've just dummied down the entire stadium into 4 6 shapes.
But I think you can do that with a lot of things. So you can take a stadium, like you said, and break it down into shapes, or you could take a barn and break it down into lines or colors or whatever, or take a person and break them down into triangles and circles that way too. The eyes are circles, the nose is a triangle. You could interpret people as stick figures if you want. And look at the one line for the trunk of the body and then other six going in the sides for the arms and legs. So that's another way that you can find inspiration. There's tons of Andy, what other techniques do you use to find a new angle when you find yourself getting stuck in a rut or you need a new voice?
Sometimes I rent a lens that I don't own. So
there's another good tip.
About once a year I rent a tilt shift lens and play with it. Because one of my favorite photographers is Vince LaFaurier, and he's known for using the tilt shift lens.
Mm-hmm. And that takes a certain amount of skill to even operate a tilt shift.
It does. It's a pain in the butt.
but it's challenging.
It's really great.
It takes you to a new perspective or a new angle in looking at photography and seeing what happens with that tilt shift, because then everything but one particular point is out of focus.
Right. Or if you use it like it was made to, your buildings aren't going bow.
Right. Your buildings don't bow. And the other way is things can look like miniature sized.
Right.
Is the classic way, well, I shouldn't say the classic, but the way that I've seen tilt shift used most commonly in recent times or in recent months, I guess I should say. People are doing a lot of that. That's a great way. Trying a new lens is a great, I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Or try a lens baby.
Yep. I own a lens baby. It does the same kind of thing with the diffused focus where it goes out from that focal point.
Try a macro lens. I mean, just try new stuff. I use Borrow lenses and I rent lenses throughout the year just to try something new.
But then, see, I can see an argument against that. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you because that is a great idea. But the flip side of that is, say you're a photographer that's just starting out, just getting into it. You don't have a lot of extra fundage or money or fundage. Yes, I just said fundage, ladies and gentlemen. But you don't have a lot of extra fiscal resources or money to tie into a $50, you know, lens that's going to cost you $50 to rent for 3 days.
You may have photographer friends that I know my friends know that my fisheye is at their disposal. All they have to do is call and ask.
Right. Yeah, that's a great way to actually experiment with new lenses. That's one of the things that I like to do is if I find myself starting to get in a rut, I'll call up one of my friends that has a fixed length, you know, a fixed focal length. And I do have one. I've got a 70mm macro from Sigma. And if I'm ever feeling like I'm stuck in a rut, I don't have to shoot with it in macro mode. I can, but I don't have to. And I'll keep right at that 70mm length, which means if I don't like the composition, guess what I got to do? I got to walk in until I get the composition I want, or I got to walk out until I get the composition I want. And then when you start walking in, you can find something else that might catch your eye. And the same goes for when you're walking out.
Right. In school, the first two semesters, we weren't allowed to shoot with anything but a 50mm.
Yeah. Well, I think the 50mm is done because that approximates the perspective of the human eye.
Right. And it's the lens that I think every photographer should own.
Yes. Wait a minute. You're saying a fixed 50?
Yes.
Interesting.
50mm, 1.8, it's $100. Go buy it.
I sold my 50mm. I had a Canon 1.8. I think I had a 1.8 apertured 50mm from Canon, and I sold it. And the reason why I sold it, and this kind of goes back to the technical, I didn't like that it was slow focus.
Mm. See, I have a 1.4, and I love it.
Now, is that the – here we go with the technical. I shouldn't even be asking this, but is that the HSM, the one that focuses quickly?
You know, I don't know. I will be honest. I don't pay a lot of attention to my gear. I know what I need.
Right. That's actually a great point. That's a perfect way to illustrate why gear is good, but it's not the most important thing. It's not the be-all, end-all. You can have all the gear in the world, and if you don't shoot with some kind of direction or passion or some meaning, if there isn't some meaning behind your photography, it's going to show in the images. And you can take, you know, a $10,000 lens, and if you don't know how to operate it or if you don't know what you're doing with it, it's not going to matter if you know how to take a good picture.
Right. Every architect can build a box. Not sure. Every architect can build a Guggenheim.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great way of saying it. And then everyone knows how to throw paint on a canvas, but not everyone can paint a Monet or
right.
Whatever. So it's just a matter of knowing that I think actually the most important thing is recognizing that you're stuck in a rut or that you haven't found a creative voice or a vision or you've stumbled somehow in identifying that vision. And that step one is recognizing that. So if you're listening to this and you're saying, yes, that's me, how do I get out of that? My first response is going to say congratulations, because in identifying what your quote-unquote problem is, you can actually address it and move past it. Because for many people, if they're not aware that they're stuck in this rut, they'll never break free from it.
Right, they're becoming cookie-cutter photographers.
Well, I'm not saying cookie-cutter photography is necessarily a bad thing, because there is an industry out there that runs on that premise. You know, the whole stock photography market is often based in having, you know, a completely blown-out background and that thumb drive or that smiling, happy person with the headset with the microphone for their customer service rep, you know, and he's grinning like a Cheshire cat into the video camera to kind of demonstrate it. But yeah, that's the kind of thing. So you can get a lot of that, and that may be successful for you because you can put it on a stock photography site or something to those ends. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you want to move away from that or move into additional things besides stock photography, you kind of have to address the passion perspective or the passion principle. That should probably be the title for this podcast. I was going to have it Finding Your Creative Voice, but I think I'm going to title it The Passion Principle now.
I like that better.
That's a good title, The Passion Principle.
And the gear, it can only take you so far. I had a photographer today ask me, well, I have a Rebel right now, and I would really like a 5D Mark II, but it's not in the budget, so should I get a 60D or a 7D? Or should I just save up for the 5D Mark II? And I didn't answer his question directly. I answered it with a question. Depends. What are you shooting, and what's your budget for a lens? Because
yeah,
if he's going to upgrade to the 5D Mark II, he's not going to be able to use his EFS lenses on it.
Right.
If he's shooting sports, as a sports photographer, he uses a 5D Mark II for sports, I tell him to buy the 7D.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the interesting thing about that is for the longest time I shot with the Canon XT. You talked about the Rebel line. That's what I got started with, was the Rebel line. The Canon XT. So there's nothing wrong with starting with the entry level and using the entry level gear as long as it suits your needs. If you ever have trouble with the gear not suiting your needs, then the question to ask yourself is, what of the gear isn't working for me anymore? And for me, the answer to that question was that the shutter speed, I'd reached the limits.
Right.
Of what I could shoot, and I shouldn't say shutter speed, it was actually frame rate, because the XT was set to a max of 3 frames per second. And
yeah,
the second,
that's what my 5D is. I'm going to upgrade here. For sports photography, an upgrade for me is actually a 7D.
So from a technical perspective, some might consider that a downgrade, but it's not because of the frame rate.
Right.
But that's what the answer was for me when it came to gear is, when do I upgrade? And the answer to the question was, when I start to bump up against the limitations of the camera.
Sometimes it's not your camera and it's your lens. People forget to
take
account for the lens. You're going to be able to capture more sports with a 7200 2.8 than you're going to be able to capture with
an 18-55 or an 18-55.
Right.
That, you know, yeah, it's exactly. And I think that's the other part of it is people think of upgrading their camera body all the time, but they don't necessarily think, like you just said, of upgrading your lens.
Right. My rule is put your money in your lenses.
Yep. I think that's the rule a lot of people are starting to realize is more important. And the relevance there actually is, and we're kind of deviating here into more of a technical discussion, but when it comes to photography equipment, one of the few things that retains value in the photography industry are your lenses. Glass is where you can see your money actually sometimes make you money. Sometimes I've heard from a couple of people where they bought a lens at a garage sale for $50 or $100 or whatever, and then come to find out this is a $1,000 lens from Canon or Nikon or whoever, and they've actually, that was a great investment, because they know if they ever want to upgrade, they can sell that for much more than what they got it for and upgrade to even better quality lens.
Right.
So I think we've probably taken this creative principle, or the passion principle, I should say the passion principle. We've taken the passion principle full circle. We've identified ways to find your creative voice, the path to take to finding your creative voice, and then ways to find a new creative voice. So let's go ahead and shift gears a little bit. We had a couple listener questions come in. Actually, I've had quite a few, and I do apologize for those that I haven't addressed since the last podcast, because it has been a while. But the questions that came in, the first one was actually kind of gear-related. It was about someone that wanted to upgrade. I think it was Mike. I'm sorry, I did not write down the order of the folks that asked these questions. And Andy's shaking her finger at me. Bad host I am. I'll get the names right when we do the show notes later. But the first question that came up came in asking that, okay, I'll just read the question. I'm considering getting a lens with image stabilization instead of the non-image stabilization, but the sticker shock seems quite painful. Is it really worth the difference? Andy.
Back to my rule of thumb. Put the money in the lenses. So yes, I think all of mine but my fixed lenses are IS.
Everything but your fixed is image stabilized. Oh, and for those of you that aren't Canon shooters, when we say image stabilized, that equivalent in the Nikon brand is vibration reduction. So IS in Canon equals VR in Nikon, and what, OS in Sigma? I don't remember.
I have no idea.
I think it's ISVR and OS are the three different monikers that are used to refer to built-in stabilization techniques for your camera when you're hand-holding. So Andy's answer to the question is, yes, invest in the IS. But even though it may be a sticker shock, it really is worth the weight in gold. I would agree with that for the most part, but I will take a little bit of an exception and say that I'm not sure IS is as useful in wide-angled work. So if you're shooting with, say, like I've got a 10-22, if someone were to say, well, the 10-22 is a $500 lens and now they're offering the 10-22 IS for $1,000, I would say don't waste your money on that, because with wide-angle work, the image stabilization really isn't going to kick in to enough of a degree unless you're shooting in really low light. That would be the only time where it might make a difference. But,
and then you can use a tripod.
Right, and then at that point you could use a tripod. So for me, wide-angle lenses, I probably would not get the IS variety, but most of the lenses, and I'd say anything longer than 50 millimeters, image stabilization is going to help you. So my answer would be yes for the most part there as well. So thank you to Mike. I think that was your question. The second question that came in is kind of interesting. They said, how wide is your website? And in parentheses, they said, in terms of photos used. And this is kind of an interesting question because we are seeing a pretty big shift in monitor sizes lately. A lot of people are moving from 19 inches to 24 inches because the prices have just dropped. Have you seen prices on monitors lately, Andy?
I haven't looked. But
oh man, but during
so cheap now in technology.
Yeah, and especially with Black Friday right after Thanksgiving, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, price of technology just drops. And if you ever want to invest in technology, this is the time to do it. But looking at like a 19-inch monitor versus a 25-inch monitor, or even a 30-inch cinema display, and I think they're even using 42-inch LDP TV screens or whatever and plugging them into their computers because they have the connector now. Mm-hmm. So people are starting to see screen sizes where 10-24 by 768 is kind of small.
Right.
You know, and so these screens are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So I think the question is more at what limit, you know, what size do you limit your photos to accommodate as much screen real estate for people as possible without making it, you know, too big so they have to scroll left and right or up and down to see the whole image. And my rule of thumb is 1,000. And I base that off of visitors that I see to the blog because I can look at analytics inside of there. And most of the visitors to the blog are using either a 1280 by 1024 or 1024 by 768. Those are the two most common sizes that I see. So for that reason, I put mine at 1,000 pixels straight. So along the longest edge, left to right, along the left to right, the horizontal. God, why did I forget that word? But 1,000 pixels across, she's making faces at me again, that's why, people. But 1,000 pixels left to right on the horizontal is how wide I usually set my images. Andy, what about you? How do you set up images for display on your website?
Most of mine are about 1,000. I know on my photo shelter site, they are at 900.
So between 900 and 1,000.
Yeah.
Around in that range. I think that's where most people are sizing their images to these days. That was actually an interesting question, but I think the standard is rapidly becoming 1,000. It used to be, I think, 800.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be the large size, and now, you know, on a 1280 by 1024 monitor or a 1600 by 900 Mac, I think the widescreen is throwing people a lot too, because it's like, well, geez, you know, I don't want it to get too distorted if people blow it up. The answer is usually 1,000. So you won't see too much distortion if people do try to resize online. So that was a great question as well. The last question is one I'm actually going to defer to Andy on, because she's done a lot more portrait work than I have. But this question was, how to get the best smiles in portrait work? And you know, we always think of the stereotypical cheese because it makes the corners of your mouth go up. But for my taste, that always looks like it's too forced or too it's like it's fake almost.
Right.
So I think the question that the reader is asking is how to get a natural smile out of someone when you're taking portraiture. So
usually, usually the first few pictures you take of a person are not going to be your keepers because they haven't gotten comfortable with you. You haven't gotten comfortable with them. Part of the trick is to make your subject comfortable. If you insist on having them say cheese, actually make them say money or hey. It gives you a better smile.
Or straw. What about straw? Hey, straw. No, that'd be different.
That doesn't work. But good try.
Yeah, good try. Thanks for playing. Next.
Ding. E for effort.
E for effort. As long as it's not an F, right?
I have a handful of really, really corny, stupid jokes that I tell. I tell them once. And throughout a session, I will go, "You're making a fake smile again. Don't make me tell you those stupid jokes again."
And then they start laughing.
Usually make them smile.
Or laugh. I think making people laugh is actually a good way to get a natural smile. I've noticed that myself. And for a lot of my time in photography, I've also been working a dual role where I worked in help desk environments. And when you talk to people in a help desk environment and you can tell that technology is just Greek to them, often a way to make them more comfortable around you, I've found, is to tell jokes occasionally.
Right.
And connect with them on a personal level to get them to relax. And I think for me, for the few times that I have done, well, I shouldn't say few, but for the select times when I've done portrait work, when I first go in, I don't even set up the camera. I just leave the camera alone and I sit down and have a conversation with them. I'm like, so, you know, nice to finally meet you. My name is Jason, blah, blah, blah. We get some pleasantries out of the way, and then we start talking. Like you said, when you ask people to bring something familiar to them, that's the important time where I would probably ask them, so what kind of a portrait do you want? Do you want something serious? Do you want something funny? Do you want something light? Do you want, you know, what kind of a story do you want me to tell? Help me know what it is you're looking for so that when we do finally get ready to set up and actually start taking pictures of you, we'll know what direction we want to go in. And if you have a conversation, you connect with people on that deeper level, you're probably going to tell a better story and take a better portrait. And then you'll get a better smile.
I find some of the best portrait photographers out there don't take themselves too seriously. They are not afraid to make a fool out of themselves.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good I think being silly is always a good thing. And it's probably why we have such fun podcasts, because we're always making faces at each other. I'm sorry, what?
If you want your subject to be serious, you should be serious, because your emotions are going to be contagious.
Right.
So if you're sitting there being a drag, being too serious because you think you're a cool photographer and you can't be stupid silly,
sure.
Well, your subject's going to come across that way too.
Right. Yeah, I think that's pretty well covered. The question of how to get the best smiles for portrait work is to get people to relax, to be silly, to don't forget to have fun. Because if you're not having, and ultimately that's what the answer is, if you're not having fun with this and your subjects aren't having fun with it, it's going to reflect in your images. So the best way to get the best portrait is to have fun with it. Don't forget to have fun, because while it may be a living, you got into it for a reason. Just try and keep that in mind. Why you got into it and what you enjoy about photography is capturing a moment and telling a story. And the best way to do that is sometimes to put the camera down and figure out what the story is that you need to tell. And that's when you can probably get the best story possible. Well, my dog just came in the room, so I think she's chiming in saying that it's time to end the podcast. So, thank you everyone for stopping in to Learning Digital Photography. Thank you, Andy, for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun talking to you. And we will have this is obviously going to go live after we finish the recording and post-production here, but we are probably not going to have another show before the end of the year. So I'd also like to take this opportunity to wish everyone happy holidays, and I know it's not politically correct, but I am going to say Merry Christmas, and I am going to say Happy New Year. I hope everyone enjoys the holiday season, and we'll see you back here in 2011. Thanks for coming on, Andy. It was a lot of fun.
See you next year.
Happy holidays, everyone. Bye.